Good morning, everyone. I was told in past years that I need to introduce myself, although this year Shuli asked for a bio, so I don't know if that exempts me from it or not, but I'll do so anyway. I'm Alan Haber, the teacher. Actually, currently, I do most of my teaching here in this building to the young women who are here during the year. They've been at this TVA program. I also teach the boys. I also teach a little bit in Mishmat. In my past life, I was director of MMY for a lot of years. Also tour guide now. Okay, I guess that's enough about me. I write and edit also. Okay. The topic of this week, my understanding, is Hellenism, or Judaism, the Jewish people's encounter with Hellenism. I hope that's the correct definition. My understanding is that Rabbi Klitzner is exploring this topic this entire week from a very, very interesting perspective. I saw some of his topics. A lot of times when we examine, and it's a fairly common theme to look at, because when the Jewish people first encountered Hellenism, there was something a little bit different about Hellenism from all of the previous foreign cultures that the Jewish people had encountered since our inception, in the sense that, on the one hand, Hellenism, like all the previous, like the ancient Canaanites, for example, like the Philistines and others, was a paganistic, idolatrous culture, which was very antithetical to the Jewish way of thinking, the Jewish way of life, on the one hand. But on the other hand, Hellenism, and I imagine that this is what Rabbi Klitzner is exploring from one angle or another, Hellenism also had within it elements that seemed to...
Something happened on the phone. Oh. I'm so sorry.
All right,
I'll see you tomorrow.
Okay. Fine. Hellenism also had within it elements and ideas that didn't necessarily seem contradictory, and perhaps could even be complementary to the ideas of the Torah. And this is what the rabbis grappled with when they, on the one hand, seemed to really, really push away Hellenism and Hellenistic ideas. The very term Chochma Yevanit appears a number of times in the Talmud as these forbidden subjects that one should not study. And at the same time, it seems that they also did manage to adapt certain aspects of it. And of course, that dilemma or that dichotomy increased in later historical periods when we encountered cultures that were actually monotheistic: Islamic culture, Christian culture, modern Western culture. So that's, I think, what's at the background of all of this. I want to, in today's shiur, I want to look at this issue from a slightly different perspective, and I hope to shed light on a particular aspect of what was going on during the Hellenistic period here in Eretz Yisrael, during the end of the Second Temple period, which I think also had a significant impact on the issues that the Jewish people were grappling with there, although it's not always something that people pay attention to. And interestingly, and particularly, I want to look at the geopolitical aspect of what was going on. It wasn't merely a contact or an encounter between two cultures. It was also an encounter between the Jewish people and a nation that came in and conquered them, and against whom they eventually fought a war and achieved some type of independence and had to grapple with how to maintain that independence. And that whole aspect of it, I think, is often overlooked, and that's what I'd like to focus on a little bit. And interestingly enough, I think that, like many things in the Second Temple period, this whole issue has a lot of relevance for us today, because there are many parallels between our own time, particularly here in Medinat Yisrael, but really the Jewish world in general, from the second half of the 20th century forward, or maybe even from the beginning of the 20th century or the end of the 19th, and the Second Temple period. In fact, I'm hopefully giving a shiur in 2 weeks here on a very different topic that may, in fact, even somewhat connect. Okay, so to begin, I'd like to sort of jump in with no context at all to a few passages in the Talmud, and then we'll zoom out from those passages and try to understand what's going on. So let's begin. I apologize also, I normally try to put translations on my source sheets. Some of the sources here are originally written in Greek, and it's all Greek to me, so those are, in fact, one of them is actually an ancient Babylonian, so those are in English translation. Those that were in Hebrew, the Aramaic, due to lack of time and lack of space, being that I already had six verses here, I neglected, and I apologize. to translate those, but I will translate myself, and I apologize for the omission. Talmud in Masechet Brachot. Again, I'm just going to jump in without any context. The Gemara, in fact, not even really within the context of the in which this discussion appears in the Talmud, but the Talmud raises what one, I guess, would have to consider a sort of philosophical / psychological question about human nature. Human nature. Amar Abaye Gemire Tava Lo Have Bisha. Abaye teaches us what he considers to be a principle about human beings. That a good person doesn't become a bad person. If someone's known to be a good person, that person's always good. And if a person is known to be an evil person, then that means that person was really always evil. A good person doesn't become evil. So suggests Abaye, perhaps a little bit of a startling or dramatic statement. And the Gemara immediately challenges it on the basis of a different statement of the rabbis. The Gemara says, "Velo, is it not possible for a good person to turn into a bad person?" V'achtiv, uveshuv tzadik mitzidkato v'asa'ave. We have a pasuk that discusses a righteous person who turns away from his righteousness and does evil. So the Gemara answers, sort of to defend Abaye's philosophical position, Hahu, that pasuk was talking about someone who was rasha meikaro, somebody who was originally evil, then became righteous, may in fact return to his evil ways, perhaps may not. But somebody who was always righteous will never turn evil, so the Gemara claims. But then the Gemara challenges it further. Velo, is that not true? V'hatnan? But we have a different statement of the rabbis, a brighter. Al ta'amin ba'atzmecha ad yom motcha. A person should never believe in himself or herself. Don't trust yourself until the very day of your death. Never trust yourself. Because you never know. If you don't watch yourself, you yourself may turn to evil ways. And what's the proof? Shahare Yochanan Kohen Gadol. Somebody who the Gemara talked, who the Braisa here refers to as Yochanan Kohen Gadol. In a moment we'll discuss which historical personage this refers to. Yochanan Kohen Gadol Shimesh Bekehuna Gedola 80 Shana. He served as the high priest for 80 years. Assumedly a very righteous person, spent 80 years serving in the Beit HaMikdash, entering the Kodesh Kodashim on Yom Kippur, every single day bringing sacrifices for 80 years. Ulubisof, and at the end of his life, Naset Tzduki, he ultimately joined the sect of the Tzdukim, one of the sects that was considered a heterodox sect that rejected the teachings of the rabbis and the Torah Shebaal Peh. And so you see, even Yochanan Kohen Gadol, who served for 80 years as the high priest, could turn into a tzduki, and therefore no one should ever trust themselves. Al tamin batzmecha ad yom motcha. And therefore, how could it possibly be that Abaye holds that a good person can't become a bad person? Here you have an actual example where it happened, and the rabbis are using this as a warning, so what could Abaye possibly be saying? And the Gemara gives an answer which is even harder to understand. Amar Abaye hu yanai hu Yochanan. Yanai and Yochanan are really the same. Now, at this point, you know, let me finish reading the Gemara, but then we're going to need to understand what historical personages are being discussed here. Rabba says, no, Abaye, you're wrong. Yanai l'chud v'yochanan l'chud. Yanai and Yochanan were two separate individuals. Yanai rasha me'ikaro v'yochanan tzadik me'ikaro. And ultimately the Gemara concludes that Rabba says that they're not the same, and Yanai was in fact always evil from the beginning to the end, and Yochanan, but he was a tzaddik from the beginning. So okay, according to Rava, so therefore Abaye, you know, will explain it his way, and Rava in fact challenges Abaye's philosophical idea and says, no, even good people can become bad people. Who's the Yanai, who's Yochanan, and what's going on here? The people referred to by the Talmud as Yochanan Kohen Gadol and Yanai HaMelech are known to us also from history as the two greatest kings of the Machut Beit Hashmonai, the Hasmonean dynasty. And we're going to look at some historical sources a little bit later on. But basically, I assume we're all familiar with the story of Chanukah. And the
chart.
Oh, great. Can I see it? So I can. Okay, excellent. So on Shuli's chart, very good here. Okay, so the person listed here as John Hyrcanus the First, John is Yochanan, okay, who is the son of Shimon, who is Matityahu had five sons. Shimon was the last of them to remain alive and was the ruler at the end of the period, and often considered the first independent ruler after that rebellion. His son, John Hyrcanus, is the one that the Gemara refers to by the title Yochanan Kohen Gadol. And his son, Alexander Yannius in Greek, is the one who the Talmud refers to as Yana Yanel. Okay, between the two of them, they each ruled this country for the majority of what's known as the Tkufat HaChashmonaim. And between the two of them, as you can see here, John Hyrcanus ruled for about 30 years, and Alexander Yanai for another 30 years or so, close to 65 years between the two of them. The whole Chashmonai dynasty depends when you consider it beginning, when you consider it ending, but the period of independence is generally viewed as from anywhere from 80 to 100 years, maybe a little bit more, depending on, again, what event you consider the beginning, what you consider the end. But these two kings, first Yochanan, or John Hyrcanus, as he's known, Yochanan Hyrcanus, we'll use the Talmudic terminology, Yochanan Kohen Gadol, and then Yanai HaMelech, Alexander Yanai. These two kings ruled for the majority of that time period, and they're basically the ones responsible for building the somewhat short-lived but relatively powerful empire of the Chashmonai. And Yochanan himself couldn't really have been a Kohen Gadol for 80 years. And assumedly, it doesn't work for his entire lifespan. Assumedly, what the Talmud is doing here is it's abstracting something. And it's viewing him as a representative of the entire time period. These were, after all, descendants of the Kohanim who served historically both as Kohen Gadol and as the king. And Abaye's position is who Yochanan, who Yanai. They're the same person. Abaye assumedly didn't think that they were the same person. He understood historically we're talking about two different people. But assumedly what the Braita means, what the Gemara means, is that Abaye considers the two of them to really be cut from the same cloth. The whole thing was rotten to its core. And the evil deeds of Yanai really were there from the beginning of Yochanan. And therefore Abaye sticks to his philosophical position. If someone's a bad apple, it means they were a bad apple. Maybe we didn't see it in the beginning. Maybe we thought the person was righteous. But if in the end the person acts up being evil, it means they were really evil from the beginning. And apparently Abaye views that not only in the context of an individual, but even a family or a dynasty or something of that nature. So Abaye says, who Yanai, who Yochanan, they're really one and the same. And Rava says, no, Yanai l'chud, the Yochanan l'chud. No, it's not true. Yochanan started with good intentions. And he really wanted to do good, but he turned evil. And Yanai, who was his son, and again, let's understand who we're talking about. Yochanan here is a son of Shimon HaChashmonai, nephew of Yehuda Maccabee, grandson of Matityahu. That's who we're talking about. And Yanai is his son. So they both agree that Yanai was evil. But Yochanan, that's the debate. That's what this Gemara is talking about. Let me zoom out a little bit and see some Talmudic accounts of what each of these two individuals did. And then we'll zoom out a little further and look at the whole historical period and try to see what might be behind these sort of abstracted Talmudic discussions. So let's take a look at the second source. Second source talks about Yanai. Yanai, who at this point was ruling a significant empire as an independent monarch, was married to a woman named Shlomtzion, Alexandra Salomi, I think that was her Greek name. She's known in the rabbinic text as Shlomtzion Hamalka. She ultimately survived and ruled after her husband independently for another 12 years. And her brother was Shimon ben Shetach, one of the great earliest of the Zugot, the earliest of the period of what's known as the Tanaim, the sages who ultimately composed the Mishnah. So it's very interesting. Yanai was married, was the brother-in-law of Shimon ben Shetach. And here in downtown Jerusalem, we all have streets named after them, right in the same area. There's Rehov Shlomtzion, Rehov Yanai, Ben Shetach. They all get along very nicely when you're trying to, on the street signs. In real life, it was a little bit different. So let's take a look at this Talmudic account. Very interesting. Very interesting agadita here. Yanai malka u malketa krichu rifta bahade hadadi. One time there was a royal banquet of some sort going on in Jerusalem, and King Yadai and his queen Shonzion were there, assumedly with many others. And then they had a problem. Umidekata lehu lirabanan lohava leinish livruchi lehu. Since he had killed all of the rabbis, there was nobody left to recite Birkat HaMazon at the end of the meal. They needed a religious functionary to come to the royal banquet and recite, you know, the, what do they say today, when they bring in a priest or somebody at the beginning of these...
Benediction,
right? They needed a rabbi to do the benediction at the end of the meal, and there were no rabbis available because they had killed them all. Yana had killed them all. Amar la ledevitu, so he said to his wife, we have a problem. Man yahiv lan gavra demivarich lan. Who can provide someone who can say the blessing for us? Amrale, she said to him, Ishtabali, I want you to swear to me, Dimaitina lecha gavra delo mitzaretle. I actually could produce someone for you, but you have to promise me first, swear, that if I produce someone who can make the bracha for you, that you're not going to kill him or even give him any real problems. Mitzaretle. Ishtabali, I said, fine, you have me, fine, I promise. I titate the Shimon ben Shetach Achua.
Before you go any further, if he went around killing rabbis, why did he feel the need for a bracha?
Yeah. Okay, why don't we leave that in the background and try to zoom out of all this? But you're highlighting the fact that these stories are presented in such an abstracted way that it seems almost absurd, right? And that's exactly what I want to try to do. I want to try to even the philosophical discussion of Abai Varava, like. Is human psychology really that simple? What is exactly is going on here is what I want to try to get to. Okay, but you're correct. You're pointing out that you know this story sounds a bit absurd. So she produced. She brought out Shimon ben Shetach, who apparently she had been protecting or hiding. This is one of a number of gemaras where the sort of tense relationship between Shimon ben Shetach and his brother-in-law Yanai comes out. So. She brings him out. Otvei bein didei ledida. So he sits Shimon ben Shetach down at the head of the table, right there between the king and the queen, right at this royal banquet, assumedly a seat of great honor. Amar le, and he said to him, Chazit, kama yikara avim nalach. He said to him, look, you see how much honor I give you? Look, I sat you here at the head of the table. Amar le, Shimon ben Shetach said to him, Lo at kamokartli ela oraita hu demokrali. No, it's not you who gives me honor. My honor comes from the Torah. It's because you needed me for my religious functionality or whatever. That's why you called me, and I'm not impressed with your gesture of honor. You could skip the next line. Amarla, he said to his wife, Kachazit lo mekabel marut. He said to his wife, you see, he's mechutzaf. He's chutzpan, right? You see, he doesn't accept authority. Okay, I'm the king, and this is the way he talks to me? All right, let's get on with it. Yahu yahavu le kasa levruche. They brought him the cup. And said, you know, Rabbi, do your stuff, say your bracha. The problem is, they didn't bother apparently even offering him to eat anything. Now you see what honor they gave him, right? And his response was, how in the world do you expect me to say Birkat HaMazon? I haven't even eaten anything. Amar le, hechi avrich, baruch she'achal yanai v'chaver. What do you say when you say Birkat HaMazon? Baruch she'achal nu mishalal. Blessed be he from whom we have eaten. What am I supposed to say? Blessed be he who Yanai and his friends ate. So what did he do? Shatye lahu kasa. He just drank the cup of wine. He said, all right, now I've had something to eat. Give me another cup and I'll say the Birkat HaMazon. Yavu le kasa achrina uvarich. That's the little anecdote here. Which actually has halachic significance about Birkat HaMazon the Gemara goes into. Not for now. What's behind that? What does it mean that he had killed out all the rabbis? The Gemara tells us... Rashi there on that Gemara points to a different Gemara in Kiddushin. It tells a story about Yanai earlier in his life. Yanai, the one that the Gemara and Brachot said they both agree was evil. But he himself doesn't appear so evil in the beginning over here. Tanya says, the bright to hear, the third source on the page, Ma'aseh b'Yanai ha-melech shehalach lekoch litsha b'minbar v'kavash sham shishim krachim. One of his many military expeditions, as I assume you heard from Shuli, both Yanai and his father, Yochanan, had conquered many territories. So he went to this particular place known as Kochlit. I'm not even sure if we know where that is. Somewhere out in the desert, and captured 60 villages. A successful military campaign. He was very happy. He just had a successful campaign. The Karal Lechol Chachmei Yisrael. And he invited all of the sages to join him in this celebration that he was going to have. Amar Lahem, and he said to them, Avoteinu hayu ochlim miluchim. Bizman shayu asukim bevinyan beit ha-mikdash. Af anu ne'echal miluchim zechel avoteinu. Ve'helu miluchim al shulchanot shel zahav ve'achlu. Sounds also very pious. He says, you know, we have to remember where we came from. Our ancestors came from very poor backgrounds. When they built the Beit HaMikdash, probably talking here about the second Beit HaMikdash, which was built in a state of great poverty. They had very, very little resources available. We'll talk about that in a few minutes. They ate salty foods, very, very basic, simple foods. Now, of course, we're in a different situation, but we have to remember where we came from. Not taking anything for granted, we're going to eat simple foods as well. And he took golden tables, which symbolized the great wealth that he had, and he served these very, very simplistic foods at this banquet, maybe sort of along the lines of eating maror or to Seder Pesach, something, that's what it sounds like, something like that idea to remember where we came from, so to speak. Seems like a very pious sort of thing to do, not to take anything for granted. Vayasham Echad, but there was among the people there, one individual, Ish Latz Levra Ublial, a very bad person, Elazar ben Poira Shmo, and apparently he had some sort of a bone to pick with the rabbis. V'yomer Elazar ben Poir liyanai melech, yanai melech libam shel prushim alecha. He says these rabbis, who are called the prushim, the opposite, the opponents of the tzedukim, they don't really like you. Umaya says, so Yanai says, what do you want me to do? They seem to be, you know, respecting me and everything. He says, Hakein lahem betzit shebein enecha. I'll prove to you what they think about you. I want you to put upon yourselves the garments of the Kohen Gadol, including the tzitz, the piece on the forehead that has the name of God written on it, and see how they react. After all, you're the high priest. Now, the high priest is really supposed to wear these things only in the Beit HaMikdash, and only when he's involved in the actual avodah, the actual service. So this is a sort of a breach of protocol. Or even chilul hakodesh, he's actually sort of desecrating these holy objects. And see how the rabbis react. So he did it. Hakim lehem betzit shebein enav. Hayasham zaken echad Yehuda ben Gedidia shmo. Among them was one sage by the name of Yehuda ben Gedidia. Ve'yomer Yehuda ben Gedidia Yanai HaMelech. He said to him, Yanai HaMelech, Rav lecha keter malchut, hanach keter kuhuna lezaru shalach. He said to him, you know what, Yanai, it's enough that you wear the crown of the king. Maybe you should leave the crown of the high priest to someone who's a descendant of Aharon. Now, it's one thing if he would have said to him, look, maybe you shouldn't be the king and the Kohen Gadol, maybe that should let someone else. But he said to him, you should leave it to a descendant of Aharon. Wasn't he himself a descendant of Aharon? What is that? He's now questioning his lineage. So the Gemara explains. Shehayu omrim imo nishbeik v'modi'im v'yuk. Apparently, there had been a rumor about Yanai that questioned his lineage. It claimed that his mother, back in the town of Modi'in, which is where the family came from, had been at one point captured by non-Jews and perhaps had been raped or defiled, or at least it was such a suspicion. And a woman who's been through such a experience is not supposed to marry a Kohen. And if she did marry a Kohen, then that would place... then that would disqualify them for serving as Kohanim. And there were some of these rumors about his mother, or something that had happened to his mother, and that his father shouldn't have married his mother. Apparently there were skeletons in the closet, rumors that had been flying around that he wasn't really qualified to be a Kohen. And in this moment of anger, it sounds like, or the Mefarshim discussed whether it was anger or whether it was a calculated decision, but they said to him, you know, you're not even really a Kohen. And that, you know, whatever. Ve'ivukasha devar v'lo nimtza. And then, not only that, and then an investigation about these rumors was conducted, and it turned out that there was no evidence to support this allegation. It wasn't true, or at least there was no evidence to support it. So these were false rumors, or at least unsubstantiated rumors. And now he had said this to Yanai, and this is bad. Ve'ibadlu chachmei Yisrael b'zam, and then all the sages that were at this party, you know, got up and left in protest. Vayomer Elazar ben Poira. So the one who started this whole thing, Elazar ben Poira, then said, Liyanei Melech. Yanei Melech, Hed Yod Shem Yisrael, Kachu Dino. If you were a regular person, maybe you should, you know, accept the fact that people storm out in protest after, you know, spreading these rumors which have already been discounted. But Ta Melech v'Kohen Gadol, Kachu Dincha. You're both Melech and a Kohen Gadol. You can allow that to happen. So Yanei says to Mumaya, he said, what do you want me to do? So he says, Imata Shomei Latzati, what I'm saying, if I were you, I would kill them. But, you know, let them treat me like this. And according to Gemara, what did Yanei say? The Torah matehela, I can't kill them. If I kill them, there won't be any Torah left. It's the same Yanai who later on had needed Shimon ben Shetach to come to his table to say Birkat HaMazon, right? Torah matehela. So this Elazar ben Poru had a simple answer for him. Nah, what are you worried about? Anyone can learn Torah. Just go on the internet. It's there. But more or less, it's what he says. Hare krucha munachet bekeren zavit. There's a library. Anyone who wants to study Torah, well, I'm not telling you to burn the Torah scrolls. We don't need them. We can just Google it, go to the shelf, and we can learn ourselves. Amar Rav Nachman by Yitzchak miyad nizrika bo apikursu. It's at that moment that heresy sort of crept its way into Yanai's thinking. Because he should have answered Torah Tenach Torah shebichtav. That helps you fine. There are books, but Torah shebal pema. We still need the people to the human interpretation. Doesn't help that you have books. We need these teachers to transmit the Misora, the tradition to us. That's what he should have said, but he didn't. Miyad v'totzeitz hara'al yidei Elazar ben Poira v'yahargu kol chachmei Yisrael. And then they went on this rampage. They killed all of the sages except for those that went into hiding, Shimon v'Shetach, and whatever. And that's the background, according to the Gemara, of all of this. And then it seems that the debate between Abaye and Rava goes back to, okay, so Yanai already, we see, seems to have had good intentions at the beginning until something set him off. And it seems that Abaye and Rava admit that no, really, deep down, Yanai was evil from the start. And the only question is, was his father also evil from the start? But again, as even the way the Talmudic Agadot explain it, it seems to be a lot more complex than the, you know, simplistic, flat descriptions here. And now, let me zoom out even further. Okay, and let's look at these people not just as individuals, which of course they were, but as kings who ruled at a certain time and place in history and who were dealing with some very, very difficult challenges. And that, I think, will shed light on all of this discussion and, like I said, on a lot of what's behind the interplay between Judaism and Hellenism, or between Jewish people and Hellenism, beyond only the cultural / ideological philosophical issues. So in order to do this, we have to go back a few hundred years. Okay, this is the time of the Bayit Sheni, the Second Temple period. You have a should we give you a timeline also?
Yeah.
Can I just see it?
No, it's great. I don't have to. Okay, great.
All right. So if we go back. Here, so the Jewish rule of the Hashmonaim, okay, she lists here as 164 to 63. Yochanan is later than that. Yochanan is 130s. But if we go back before that, we have the revolt of the Maccabim in 164, 161. And prior to that, the entire Hellenistic period begins in 332 or 333, when Alexander the Great conquered Eretz Israel. But the Second Temple period begins a little more than 200 years before that. And even prior to that, prior to the destruction, to the building of the Second Temple, of course, there had to be a destruction of the First Temple. Okay, so let's go back to 586 BCE for a minute.
Just to understand where this all came from.
And I want to just look very quickly at a few brief passages in the Tanakh that describe the destruction of the first Beit HaMikdash and the building of the second. So here, in Yirmiyahu. Notice that this is one of the places where Yirmiyahu prophesizes the destruction of the first Beit HaMikdash. And notice how it's described here. Hadavar asher hayal Yirmiyahu al kol am Yehuda b'shana ha-revi'it li-Yoyakim ben-Yoshiyahu melech Yehuda, hi ha-shana ha-rishonit le-Nevuchadnetzar melech Bavel. When Nevuchadnetzar, the one who was going to destroy the first Beit HaMikdash, came to power, there was still a king ruling in Yerushalayim, a king who was a descendant of David HaMelech. For the last approximately 400 years, there had been a king, a sovereign king ruling in Jerusalem, Ben Achar Ben, a descendant directly from King David. The Davidic dynasty ruled in this city for 400 years. Some of the kings were righteous, some of them were wicked, some of them had more power, some of them had to bow a little bit to, or a little bit more than a little bit to the various empires. Some of them fought wars and won, some fought wars and lost, some had to pay tribute, but in all cases they were independent kings. And Yirmiyahu tells them that this is all about to come to an end. At one point, there had been another kingdom, Malchut Yisrael, which 150 years earlier had been conquered and had been, the 10 tribes had been taken to exile because different Nevi'im warned them that if you don't listen to Hashem, you're going to be captured, and ultimately that's what happened. But now it's been another 150 years, and Yirmiyahu, the last prophet who walked the streets of the city before the Churban, is telling the people that if you don't do tshuva soon, it's going to be too late. And at a certain point, he stopped saying that and started saying it is too late, and it's time to just accept the decree. Lachen, let's just skip to the bottom there. Lachen, koma Hashem tzvaod yana shelo shmaatem et dvarai. Hineni sholeach velakachti et kol mishpachot tzafon num Hashem. Vel nubuchanetzim elach bavel, vav yotim el haaretz hazot, vel yoshveh, vel kol agoyim el saviv, vel haramtim. He says that Nebuchadnezzar, who just became the king of Babel, this is the first year of his reign, is going to conquer this entire area. He's going to destroy many of the neighboring countries, just like others did before him, just like Ashur did before him, and Aram before them. But among them, he's going to destroy Yerushalayim as well. He's going to destroy the land completely, and you're going to serve, you're going to be enslaved to him for a period of 70 years. There's a deadline, there's a deliberate exact time frame for how long this is going to take. And in fact, the next sources show from the book of Malachim that's exactly what happened. What I want to point out here is that the destruction of the first Beit HaMikdash, unlike the destruction of the second one that took place hundreds of years later, was a complete destruction. It was not only a destruction of the Mikdash. Here. This is Sefer Malachim Bet now. 19 years later from the first Nevuah, Ba Nevuzaradan, Rav Tabachim, Nevuzaradan, one of his generals, came. Eved Melech Bavel Yerushalayim, Vayisrof et Beit Hashem, he burned the Beit HaMikdash, Ve'et Beit HaMelech, and he burnt down the king's palace too, until the very last moment. Sidkiyahu, the king, was still ruling in Yerushalayim. And in fact, he was taken captive. His own children were slaughtered in front of his eyes. He was blinded. He was taken to Bavel. But he himself was not killed. And eventually, he was allowed in Bavel to attain, to live out his years with some sort of, he was blind, but to live out his years with some sort of dignity as the leader of the Jewish people in exile. Ve'et chomot Yerushalayim saviv natzu. They broke down the walls of Yerushalayim. Kol chel chastim asher rav tabachim. Most of the people were slaughtered or were taken away into exile, and only a small number of people remained. Some of the farmers, it says, were allowed to remain in the land. Okay, so the destruction of the first Beit HaMikdash was not only destruction of the Beit HaMikdash, it was the destruction of the entire nation. And until that moment in time, for 400 years, the Jewish people had lived in the land of Yehuda, prior to them also in the other areas, under the sovereign rule of a king from the house of David in Yerushalayim, and other kings in Shomron. And even prior to that, even prior to the first kings during the period of the Shoftim, since the days of Yehoshua, or perhaps, if you want, since the days of Yitzhak Mitzrayim, since the days of Moshe Rabbeinu, Am Yisrael had been an independent, sovereign nation for somewhere around 800 years. And what came to an end on Tisha B'Av in the year 586 BCE was not just the first Beit HaMikdash, but what we would call today the Jewish state came to an end. And the next time that the Jewish people existed as a sovereign independent nation was briefly during the period of the Chashmonaim. And the next time after that was in 1948. Okay? That's an important thing to understand. How did the second temple come to be? And what made it different than the first temple? So if you look in Sefer Ezra, in a minute we're going to take a look at Sefer Ezra. Sefer Ezra itself talks about how when they built the second Beit HaMikdash, there was a great celebration, and most of the people were rejoicing, except for the old people. Right? Most of the people were rejoicing because they saw something great. We have a Beit HaMikdash. The old people still remembered, it was 70 years, there were some people, maybe in their 80s, 90s, who remembered the first Beit HaMikdash. And they were crying. They said, this is the Beit HaMikdash. What? And the rabbis elaborate all the miracles that took place in the first Beit HaMikdash that were not here. The Aron was not there. So many things that, you know, this was just a pale reflection. So that's in terms of the Beit itself. But there's more. Let's take a look. How did the second Beit HaMikdash come to be just 7 years after the first? So the book of Ezra opens with these words. Uvishnat achat lekoresh melech paras. When the end of the 7 years was approaching, still about 20 years left, about 50 years since the Churban, Heir Hashem et Ruach Koresh Melech Paras. God awakened the spirit of Koresh, Cyrus, the king of Persia, who in the meantime had conquered the Babylonians and had instituted a new empire that was to rule the Middle East, and to rule Eretz Yisrael for a few hundred years, and to rule in other parts of the world for much longer. Vayaver kol b'kol malchuto v'gam b'michtav l'mor, and he issued a proclamation throughout his kingdom, saying, Komar koresh melech paras, kom amlechot ha'aretz natan li Hashem elokei ha'shemayim, v'upakad alai livnot lo bayit b'Yerushalayim asher b'Yudah. The way the biblical text here describes it, in a moment we'll see that this may not have been his actual words. The way the biblical text describes it, Koresh was this righteous person who saw himself as a shliach of God. He says, God has appointed me king of the world in order that I should rebuild his house in Yerushalayim. That's why I became the emperor. Nebuchadnezzar was his shliach to destroy it, and I'm his shliach to rebuild it. And therefore, I issue this proclamation, Mi vachem mikol amo yehi elohavi mo, v'yal Yerushalayim asher b'Yudah, v'even et Beit Hashem Elokei Yisrael, hu ha'elokim asher b'Yerushalayim. I therefore give permission, any of you Jews that were exiled by Nebuchadnezzar, or perhaps whose parents or maybe even grandparents were exiled and are living in the areas under my reign, you have full permission to return to your ancient homeland or to your homeland, and to rebuild the Beit HaMikdash. V'chol anishar mikol mekamot asher hu gar sham, and anyone who's not going to make aliyah, not going to go back, so your job is to write checks. That's what it says. Sham yinasu anshei mekamo bekesef hu zahav hu rechus v'beima, you have to give donations to build the Beit HaElokim asher b'Yerushalayim. And in fact, it says that they went back, and not only that, look at the bolded psukim a little bit later down there. V'hamelech koresh hotzi et klei Beit Hashem, asher hotzi Nebuchadnezzar miYerushalayim, v'yitnei b'Beit Elohav. Nebuchadnezzar had plundered the Beit HaMikdash, or his emissaries, before they burnt it down. And he had taken various kelim from various of the vessels that were there in the Beit HaMikdash. And he had brought them to Babylonia and placed them in the temple of his gods. This was a common practice in the ancient worlds, right? Ancient peoples believed, pagan peoples believed, that once you believe in multiple gods, so you have no problem also believing in other people's gods. And if you believe in only one god, so then other religions or other gods are false. But if you believe in, if you have worshipped 20 gods, if there could be 20, there could also be 30 or 40 or 80. So, generally speaking, ancient peoples believed that all the gods were real. And that they worshipped their gods and we worshipped our gods. And if a nation would fight a nation, usually both sides understood that the gods are warring with one another also. And if one nation vanquished another, usually both of them understood that obviously the god of the victorious nation had vanquished the god of the vanquished nation. And then they would take the vessels from the temple of the vanquished god and bring them as spoils of war and place them before the victorious god, and the vanquished people would often accept that without any, you know, why should I worship my god? My god, I'm going to worship his god now. Right? The same worshiping, I have to serve him as a slave and my god has to serve his god as well. So that's what Nebuchadnezzar did. If you remember back in Sefer Shmuel, the Plishtim did the same thing. Right? When they destroyed the Mishkan in Shiloh, this is totally different time period, of course. Right? They brought the Aron and placed it in front of their god. In my opinion, one of the most funniest passages in the entire Tanakh. It's clearly satirical. Right? They place the Aron down, and then the idol falls down in the morning, and its arms break off, and its head breaks off, and people get sick. And finally, they say, we need to send this Aron back there. right? But it's, that's showing you the way a pagan thinks and the way the Tanakh is trying to teach us to think. So Nebuchadnezzar had done that. He had taken the vessels from the Beit HaMikdash and had brought them to his royal chambers, to his royal capital, and had placed them in the temples of the Babylonian gods. But now Koresh, who says, I have been appointed by God, the real God, to rebuild the Beit HaMikdash, removes those objects. Vayotzieim Koresh Melech Paras, Ayad Matridat HaGizbar, even gives the name of the person who was responsible for doing this. Vayisparem L'Shesh Betzar HaNasil Yehuda, gives them to Shesh Betzar, one of the leaders of the Jewish people who's going to lead the delegation going back, and he returns them to him. Kol Kelim Zahav LaKesef, it says in one, Kol HaKol He'ele Shesh Betzar, he gave them to him and said, here, first of all, I'm giving you permission, I'm giving you money. He gave them money from his own royal treasuries, and certainly the things that were plundered, that were stolen by Nebuchadnezzar, the previous ruler who I conquered, I'm righting the wrong and giving them back to you, and go ahead and build your holy temple. So the Tanakh presents Koresh here as really an astoundingly righteous person. Now what's interesting, and that perhaps many are familiar with this, is that there is a bit of a historical evidence for something a little bit similar and a little bit different. Okay? If you see there that little cylinder, which you can see in the British Museum in London, I was there a few months ago, I saw it myself. You can also see replicas of it at various places. I think there might be a replica in the Israel Museum, I don't recall, but there's definitely one in the Tower of David Museum.
Biblical Lands Museum.
Oh, in the Bible Lands Museum. Okay, right. Okay, right. That's where it is. And there's also one, it's a small cylinder. That was uncovered by the British in the 19th century in what's today Iraq, and what was then, what was once upon a time Babel, that contains, apparently this was made to be placed on, this was also like a belief that they used to have, that they would build things, they would put like inscriptions, sort of dedications under the walls of the cities that they were building. And this was apparently written by, or at the command of, Koresh, the same Koresh is mentioned there. And it describes a policy that's not identical to what it says in the Tanakh, but interestingly parallel, and there's since then been debate among historians and archaeologists about exactly how much linkage one can make here. But basically what you see here is that he talks about how, he's not talking here in this particular cylinder, it doesn't say a word about Yerushalayim and the Beit HaMikdash, but it does say that he had such a policy into other lands he conquered, lands that were part of the Babylonian, part of Babylonia, that he returned the people to their, allowed people to return home to their original settlements, and the gods, for example, the land of Shumer and Akkad, I returned them unharmed to their cells in the sanctuaries that make them happy. So it seems that Koresh actually did have a policy, whether it was based on some sort of theological idea or whether it was a different political philosophy. Right? Instead of trying to subjugate people, by force, and perhaps to rule them as a benevolent monarch who wants to show them that he's not interested in harming their culture, and he's not interested in, to the contrary, everyone's invited to go back there. There's a new administration now, right? Everyone's invited to go back to their homelands, and everyone's invited to restore their, you know, we believe in freedom of religion, and if your temples were plundered and taken to Babylon, I'm returning them. So we see here in this cylinder that the British found a policy that was applied by Koresh in other places, which somewhat matches the policy that the Tanakh describes about Yerushalayim. Now, of course, Sefer Ezra presents it as though he said, I believe in God and I'm a shaliach of God. Maybe he said that to the Jews, or maybe that's the way the Tanakh is interpreting. Right? It starts off by saying, Heir Hashem et Ruach Koresh. Right? That God really controls all of history. Maybe Koresh himself didn't say it exactly in those words. Maybe he said it in words that were similar to the words that he wrote in the cylinder about Babylon. Maybe this was just part of his overall policy. But the Tanakh is telling us, but this is really, Yirmiyahu HaNavi said there's going to be 70 years, and now the 70 years have come, and look what happened. God placed this king in power, and he caused him to have these policies. And so one way or another, though, what's important for us to understand is that the second Beit HaMikdash was built with permission. With permission from Koresh. That, by the way, also has halachic ramifications for Kedushat Eretz Yisrael, the Gemara discusses. It wasn't taken by force. It was given through permission. And if you go through more of Sefer Ezra discusses what happened. That Sheshbatzar, Zerubbabel, they came back, they brought the people back. Only a few people answered the call to go back to Eretz Yisrael. Most chose to remain in exile. Again, certain parallels that we have to our own time, perhaps. And therefore, the people who came were dealing with very, very meager economic resources. Again, I see parallels to the 19th century, early Zionist movements. And okay, that we'll talk about in 2 weeks. But eventually, they managed, not only that, they were opposed by the locals, the local residents of Eretz Yisrael, who had come, either some of them since the destruction, some of them from beforehand, the Shomronim and others, didn't like these new immigrants coming and tried to obstruct them and appeal to the powers in Persia, right? I remember there was a Balfour Declaration, and then it didn't take long before the British started getting pressure to step back from it, and that's exactly what happened. Same thing exactly. The parallels are incredible, right? At one point, therefore, they received an order from Persia to stop building, and the building was delayed by quite a while until the next king, Dariavesh, again issued a second proclamation, again giving permission, and it took, therefore, over 20 years until they actually managed to build the second Beit HaMikdash, which the Tanakh tells us, Sefer Ezra tells us, took place exactly at the end of the 70 years that Yirmiyahu had prophesied. Okay, but the whole thing was done only with permission. They were given permission from Koresh, they were allowed to start. When Koresh removed that permission, they had to stop. Only when Dariavesh renewed the permission, or issued a new permission, were they able to continue. And the permission was to build a temple. It was not, and to return to the land of Israel. Jews were allowed to return to their land to reestablish not just a temple, but to reestablish a Jewish society, but not an independent state, by no means. You're subjects of the Persian Empire. And we see that over 50 years later as well. Look at the next page, Nehemiah. Nehemiah, who came, we're now, Vahi Bechodesh Nisan Shnat Esrim L'Artachshasta HaMelech. This is 50 years after the building of the second temple. We're now in the fourth Persian king. Artaxasta, Artaxerxes, or something like that in the English. It's actually, I think, Greek writing of it. And we're told that about this person named Nehemiah ben Chachliah, who the first chapter of Sefer Nehemiah tells us he was an important person, a member of the royal court, a Jew who had reached already a very high position in the Persian government. And he heard that 50 years after the second temple had been built. 70 years after Koresh's proclamation, there was a Beit HaMikdash, but Yerushalayim was still in ruins, to a large extent. The walls of the city were still in ruins. There were still many things that had been burnt. Only a few people were there. And he wanted to do something about it. And he tells us how he managed to go. And Nehemiah is the one who managed to go and really, really reestablish or move the people forward into a more established peoplehood. How did he do that? So again, Vasaita, he was serving wine to the king as part of the functionaries of one of the royal, that was part of the ceremonial aspects of being a government minister, that you would physically serve the king. Like back in ancient Egypt also, the Sara Mashkim and the Sara Ofim, they weren't the butler and the waiter, right? Like in the Broadway play, they were the Sar HaMashkim and the Sar Ofim, the minister of agriculture and the minister of wine and commerce, who, as part of their ceremonial roles, also would serve the king to show that they are. Right? It wasn't just a butler. So here's well, he had that same function. He was serving the king wine. Ve'lo hayiti ra lefanav. Until this point, I never looked upset. But the king said to me on that day, Madu panecha rayim, you look upset. I know you're not ill. So ainzakim roa lev, you must be upset about something. What's wrong? Va'ira harbe miod, and I suddenly got very afraid. Oh, the king saw that I'm upset. Va'omar lamelech, hamelech leolam yichyeh, may the king live forever. Madua lo yeru panai. But why should I not be? You want to know why I'm upset? I'm upset because asher ha'ir beit kivrot avotai chariva. My city, the city where my ancestors are buried, my ancient homeland is still in ruins. So what do you want? The king said to me. And I immediately uttered a silent prayer, praying that the king's going to grant my request. He says to him with great submission, if your royal highness agrees, and if I find favor in your eyes, asher tishlachen el Yehuda el ir kivrot avotai ve'evnena, please grant me permission to go back to my ancient homeland, to the city where my ancestors are buried, and rebuild it. Vayomer li amelech, vashegal yoshevet etzlo, the king with the queen sitting next to him, said to him, ad matai yem halachacha, matai tashuv, okay, how much time do you need, and when will you come back? And I answered him, vayishlacheni, vatnalozman, I gave him a deadline, and he agreed me to go. And the king, in fact, allowed Nehemiah to go, and it says later on that he even gave him royal documents to ensure his way, and also gave him some money to help to go for a set period of time, but it has to come back. I'm giving you a leave of absence from your job here in Shushan to go and to rebuild Yerushalayim. And it's on that basis that Nehemiah went and rebuilt Yerushalayim. Again, completely with permission. And he has to beg for permission, and he has a certain timeline. The Jewish people at this point are not an independent nation any longer. They are subjects of the Persian Empire, and they accomplish whatever they accomplish only through the good graces of the Persian Empire. For the first time in history, they are no longer a nation, but a community, a religious community. For the first time, you could talk about something called the Jewish religion. Not that there wasn't a religion before, of course there was. They believed in a God. They worshipped in their Beit HaMikdash, but that was simply the expression of their national culture, just like all other nations in the ancient world worship their gods. Our God was different. There's only one God. But the way in which it was expressed was through a nation. And that's the way it was meant to be from Har Sinai. When we received the Torah, we were told, Datem Tiyuli, Mamlechet Kohanim V'goy Kadosh. A kingdom, a nation. A kingdom of priests, a holy nation. And that was the way things were from the time we received the Torah, or from when we came out of Mitzrayim, or when we went into Eretz Yisrael, however you want to define it. In the time of Yeshua, in the time of the Shoftim, we didn't have a single leader. We didn't have a king. But we also weren't ruled over by anyone else. Independent collection of tribes, perhaps. And then for over 400 years, first King Shaul, and then King David and his descendants for 400 years, until that Churban, which changed everything. And although the temple itself was destroyed for a relatively short period of time, the Jewish people were changed dramatically. And during the entire period of Bayit Sheni, until we get to the Hashmonaim, the Jewish people are not a nation any longer in the classic sense of the term. They're a religious community, one of many subjects of the Persian Empire. And as far as we know, as far as I know, there's no record whatsoever of any attempt to rebel or any desire even on the part of the Jewish people for political independence or sovereignty. They seem to have accepted that this is their situation. And in fact, the fact that they were able to worship their God and observe their religion freely seems to have been just fine with them. It's very telling, by the way. During this entire time period, who was the highest official in Yerushalayim? Who was the head of the Jewish community in Eretz Yisrael? The Kohen Gadol. In our terms, the chief rabbi. Right? They're not a nation anymore. There's a governor, a pecha in Persian, who rules here on behalf of the Persian, this was called Pachvat Ya'ad, the province of Yehuda. There's a governor who at times was a Jew even, but he serves as a governor appointed by the Persian government. Sometimes a Jew, sometimes a non-Jew, but he's a governor on behalf of the Persians. The leader of the Jewish community was the Kohanim, and on top of them, the Kohen Gadol, because they're a religious community. And therefore, the religious leaders are their leaders. There's no melech. There is no king. And so things went throughout the entire Persian period, which lasts for a few hundred years. And into the Hellenistic period as well. Alexander the Great conquers the land from the Persians in 333 or so. I think Julie wrote 332 BCE. And a whole new whole new empire is ruling here. A whole new culture, as we mentioned, a culture that's very different from Persian culture, that brings its own opportunities and its own challenges. But in terms of the political orientation and the way things are going to work, it's exactly the same. Now, instead of the government being, the local government being somebody appointed by the emperor over there in Persia, so now it's a local governor appointed by an emperor, in theory in Greece, but very shortly afterwards, first in Egypt and then in Syria. Right? Meaning, we're still a religious community, part of some empire, ruled by those emperors. And even the Talmudic description here, on the next source, in Yoma, about how Alexander the Great came to Yerushalayim, which has a parallel in the writings of Josephus, actually. A little bit different, but somewhat parallel. Tells us that the Shomronim, the same Shomronim, the Samaritans, the same ones who had tried to stop the building of the second Beit HaMikdash at several different points, also tried to get Alexander to destroy the Mikdash that they didn't succeed in stopping. And it tells us that Shimon HaTzadik, who according to Gemara was a Kohen who lived here in Yerushalayim at that time, Kohen Gadol, heard about this. So second line there. Ba'u ve'odiyu at Shimon HaTzadik. He heard that the Shomronim were trying to incite Alexander to destroy the Beit HaMikdash. Me'asa lavash bigdei kehuna. He put on the royal garments. Perhaps a parallel to what Yanai later did, right? Put on the, not the royal garments, I'm sorry, the garments of the Kohen Gadol, sorry. V'nitatef bigdei kehuna. He went out with a delegation. He dressed in the big day kuna and at the head of a delegation of the elders of the people. Vavukot shel orbi dehem, carrying torches. Alexander was approaching with his armies, and they were approaching with this delegation, unarmed, peaceful delegation led by the Kohen Gadol. And he reached, according to the Gemara, he reached Antipatris, which is near today's Rosh HaHayim. According to Josephus, a similar scene happened much closer to Yerushalayim, but whatever. They met one another. Kevan Shira'a l'Shimon HaTzadik, when Alexander saw this Kohen, Yarad mimer kavto v'shtachave lefanav. He bowed down to him. Amru lo, and they said to him, Melech gadol kamotcha yishtachave l'yudi zeh, what? You're emperor of the world, you're bowing down to this Jew. Amar lahem, dmut yukno shazem menatzachet lifnei lifanai bevet milchanti. I have seen a vision as I was winning my wars of somebody that looked like this person dressed in these unique clothing. I didn't understand what it was. But now I see that it's through the merit of this man that I've won these wars. Amar lahem, lama batem. He said, why did you come? And they said, Amru efshar bayit shemit palim bo alecha. A house, the temple, where we pray for you. We've been praying in our temple on your behalf. Right? Playing on it. You saw the image of the Kohen Gadol. It's because we've been praying to God on your behalf, and we're going to let these no good people, Shomronim, convince you to destroy that temple. And it says here in the Gemara that, they convinced him. And in fact, instead of destroying their temple, he went to Har Gerizim and destroyed the temple of the Shomronim that was standing on Har Gerizim. And that's how, according to the Gemara's account, Yerushalayim was spared by Alexander, and the Jewish people came under the canopy of the Hellenistic empires. And perhaps, of course, Talmudic Agadot are even more metaphorical than the Psukim in the Tanakh. Perhaps this is not an exact historical event either, but the same way that Sefer Ezra presented Koresh's decrees as something that came from God, so the Gemara is making a similar statement here as well. That Yerushalayim was spared by Alexander because ultimately he, so to speak, metaphorically at least, saw that it was the hand of God that brought him, the hand of the God who was worshipped in Yerushalayim, who brought him to this power. Which means that from the days of Koresh until the days of the Maccabim, which is about, 530-something until 160-something, so what are we talking about? We're talking about 350 years or so? The Jewish people existed as a religious community, subjects first of Persia, and then of the Ptolemaic Greeks, and then of the Seleucid Greeks, a religious community, and who accepted the fact that they're subjects of these various empires. And again, at least as far as I know, there's no indication that they ever tried to rebel until the days of the Maccabees. And then everything changed. What changed so suddenly? So here we switch to historical texts. And I'm not going to leave everything with you here. But first we have the book of Maccabim Aleph, which is the most important historical text we have about the revolt of the Maccabim. It's a book that was written originally in Hebrew. It sounds like its author was hoping it would be considered part of Tanakh. It was not accepted as part of the Tanakh, although it was preserved by certain Christian denominations who did consider it as part of the Holy Scriptures, and therefore we've lost the Hebrew original. We have only a Greek translation of it, but it's clear from the Greek that it was originally written in Hebrew, and it's considered the most important historical source that tells us what happened back then. Okay, so I'm not going to read the whole thing, but let's just start from the part that's here on the page. And there came out of them a wicked root, Antiochus, surnamed Epiphanes. This is Antiochus the V, Seleucid king, the second or third Seleucid king after the... But you, surely I assume spoke about the two different Greek dynasties, the Ptolemies and the Seleucids? No? Okay, I'm sorry. So brief... Just in parentheses. Alexander the Great conquered the entire Middle East, so to speak, and parts of Europe and Asia Minor as well. But shortly upon his death, his empire split into different groups by different Greek generals. And there was one empire based in Egypt and one empire based in Syria. And as always, Eretz Yisrael's in between those two, and the two are fighting over them. For the first 100 years or so, it was the Ptolemy dynasty in Egypt that ruled Eretz Yisrael. And they were constantly at war with the Seleucid dynasty, which was based in Syria. And Eretz Yisrael was sort of the frontline defenses against them. And then the Seleucids from Syria managed to defeat them and conquered Eretz Yisrael. And then the local population of Eretz Yisrael was then ruled from the Greeks. The Greeks, we call them, they're Hellenists. Greek culture, their capital was in Antioch, which is in Syria. And Antiochus V is now already, I believe, the third ruler since Eretz Yisrael came under their control. And in those days went there out of Israel wicked men, who persuaded many, saying, "Let us go and make a covenant with the heathen that are round about us. For since we departed from them, we have had much sorrow." So this device pleased them well. Then certain of the people were so forward hearing that they went to the king, who gave them license to do after the ordinances of the heathen, whereupon they built a place of exercise at Jerusalem, a gymnasium, according to the customs of the heathen, and made themselves uncircumcised. You can't really make yourself uncircumcised, but there is a way to... They developed, actually, at this time, a surgical procedure to make a man who was circumcised appear as if he wasn't. Moshech or Lato in the Talmudic terminology. This was very important for them because part of the Greek culture were these athletic competitions, and they competed nude, and therefore if you were seen to be circumcised, you were... So they actually developed a procedure to sort of some kind of plastic surgery, I guess we'd call it, to hide the fact that they had been circumcised, and forsook the Holy Covenant and joined themselves to the heathen and were sold to do mischief. So here we have already a record of the fact that there were some Jews that were aligning themselves with Hellenistic culture, and that had happened already previously, before this time of Antiochus V, even under the Talmies, particularly those Jews who lived in the coastal plain areas, which was much more heavily populated by Hellenists and was on the main highway where the battles were taking place. The Jews who lived up in the area around Yerushalayim, up in the mountains, were less of... They were mostly country folk and farmers, and who typically are more traditional people, and they were away from the major population centers. But in the time of Antiochus the V, these people got permission from him to build a Greek gymnasium in Yerushalayim. And after that, Antiochus had smitten Egypt and returned again, etc. Here it talks about how in this paragraph he actually came and conquered Yerushalayim for whatever reasons he had, and which was a complete break with what had been done by the Hellenists before him and by the Persians before them. He talks about how he conquered Yerushalayim, how he destroyed the city to a large extent, defiled the temple. And then if we turn the page, moreover, King Antiochus wrote to his whole kingdom that they should be one people, and everyone should leave his laws. So all the heathen agreed according to the commandments of the king. Yea, many also of the Israelites consented to his religion and sacrificed unto idols and profaned the Sabbath. For the king had sent laws by messengers unto Jerusalem and in the cities of Judah. They should follow the strange laws of the land and forbid burnt offerings and sacrifice and drink offerings in the temple, that they should profane the Sabbaths and festival days, pollute the sanctuary and holy people, set up altars and groves and chapels of idols and sacrifice swine's flesh and unclean beasts, that they should leave their children uncircumcised, make their souls abominable with all matter of uncleanness and profanation, to the end that they may forget the law and change all the ordinances. Okay, so here we have a historical record of the persecution, of the laws passed by Antiochus Epiphanes prohibiting practice of the Jewish religion. And this was why he did that and what the historical motives were for that is a subject for historians to debate. But the point is, this was a complete break from the policies of all those who had preceded him, at the least since the time of Koresh. Until now, the Jews have been allowed freedom of religion. No political sovereignty, no political independence whatsoever, nor did they seem to seek it. They were a religious community. And the days of the first Beit HaMikdash were long gone. The days of Malchut Beit David were long gone. They were a religious community worshiping their God according to their traditions, paying taxes to whoever it was who was ruling their country, be he Persian, be he Ptolemy Hellenist, be he Seleucid Hellenist, until the days of Antiochus. And suddenly, Yerushalayim is defiled, the Beit HaMikdash is defiled, and there are laws prohibiting the observance of the Jewish religion, and that's when the Jewish people rebelled. Okay? And here we have a description in the next paragraph. Maybe I won't read it inside because I'm almost out of time, but the description here of the rebellion that broke out in the city of Modi'in city. At the time, it was a small village of Modi'in where Matityahu, the Kohen, lived, and there was a law that had been passed that every single Jewish village would have to offer sacrifices to Greek gods, one after another. And when it came to Modi'in, the people that were sent there from the king spoke to Matityahu, hoping to, you know, they wanted things to go smoothly, they didn't want any trouble, and they figured Matityahu, if he himself would participate in the worship, So things might go more smoothly, and he refused. They offered him all kinds of bribes. He refused, and then somebody else got up to do it, and Matityahu, it seems was an old man at this point, charged up to the stage in the center of town and killed the Jew that was offering the pagan sacrifices and killed a few of the Greek soldiers that were there and screamed to the people to follow me, and they ran off to the hills, and this began the rebellion of the Maccabim. Four wars later, Yerushalayim was purified, and that's what we celebrate on Hanukkah. Another four wars later, Yehuda Maccabee died in battle, defending a kingdom that at this point was more or less independent. Another 20 years after that, his younger brother Shimon was already ruling over a more or less independent Jewish kingdom. And it's from that that we get to the days of Yochanan Kohen Gadol. So let's understand something. The Jewish people were an independent nation from their very inception as a people, Yitzhak Mitzrayim, Matan Torah, Yeshua Binun, whatever point you want to pick, all the way through the destruction of the first Beit HaMikdash. And then things changed dramatically. And even though we talk about the second Beit HaMikdash being built shortly afterwards, the Beit HaMikdash was rebuilt, true. Some of the Jews came back there to Israel, true. But the fact that we had lost our independence, that didn't change. And that didn't change all the way until the rebellion of the Maccabim. And the rebellion of the Maccabim came about because we were no longer able to practice our religion. And the Maccabim finally realized that, look, what was important to the Jewish people at that time, it seems, was their religious, cultural, spiritual independence. And they had that by the good graces of the king. First Koresh, and then those who came after him for the various rulers. But that's very fragile. Maybe it didn't seem that way until a king arose who took it away. And suddenly it became clear that if you want to preserve your spiritual identity, you need to use military power. Political power, you need to be independent. And that's what led about the revolution of the Maccabees. But now let's get to Yochanan. Yochanan Hyrcanus, Yochanan Kohen Gadol. The one who maybe was good in the beginning, maybe wasn't good in the beginning. The one who ultimately turned bad, according to the Gemara. The father of Yanai, who turned really bad, who it seems also... That whole thing was going on. And let's take just a brief look at, I don't have time to read everything inside, but you can take this, you can read it at your leisure. what Josephus tells us about the challenges that he faced. Okay, this is from Josephus Flavius, Antiquities of the Jews. After the Maccabean Wars, the last of the Maccabees, Shimon finally, and there's a whole thing that went on there back and forth, and at the meantime, the Seleucid Greeks had their own power, they were still fighting the Persians in the east, and Rome is a rising power on the rest that, in the west that was also threatening them, and some of the Maccabees made deals with the Romans, alignments with the Romans, as crazy as it sounds in hindsight, right? The Romans who ultimately destroyed everything, the Maccabees themselves had made diplomatic contacts with them. And what happened? It tells us here, maybe just for lack of time, I'll summarize without reading it inside, that when Yochanan ascended to the throne, he was attacked by Antiochus VII, the grandson of the Antiochus who had actually, for the first time, really managed to threaten to retake Yerushalayim again. They basically had Yerushalayim under siege, and the situation was not looking good. Oops. And he cut a deal, basically, with Antiochus. Antiochus, and there's one sentence I should read to you, or read with you. If you look on the second to last page there, the bolded part. Right before the gold departed, it was Sukkot, and they asked for a truce. And not only did he agree to a truce, Yerushalayim is in siege, and it was Sukkot. And Yochanan Hyrcanus asks the Greek king on the outside of the city, look, it's our holiday, maybe you can give us a week off from fighting. And not only did he give him a week off, he sent sacrifices into the city to be offered in the temple. Which was quite a different conduct from Antiochus Epiphanes, who, when he had taken the city, offered swine upon the altar and sprinkled the temple with the broth of their flesh in order to violate the laws of the Jews and the religion they derived from their forefathers. This king said, look, I'm conquering your city, but I'm willing to let you have your religious freedom, just like those who came before me did. And Hyrcanus had to agree, and he accepted it. And he then went ahead and joined with Antiochus and gave his soldiers to support them in some of his campaigns. And then later on, when Antiochus himself was killed in battle, he saw an opportunity, and he came back, and he conquered some of the territories around him and suddenly built himself up as an independent king. In order to do that, though, he needed, it says here, he needed to hire mercenary fighters, as the Jewish people couldn't fight the wars on their own behalf. He had to hire non-Jews to fight on their behalf, non-Jews who then became part of his army with their own traditions and their own cultures. He conquered the land of Edom, and in a major break with the practice of all those who came before him and pretty much anyone who came after him, he forced the entire nation to convert to Judaism. And it's from those people that Herod eventually came. Herod's father, Antipater, was converted. He or his grandfather had been converted by Yochanan Hyrcanus. And Herod's the one who eventually cemented the Romans' control over the country. What I'm trying to show you is that what I think is behind those ambivalent descriptions in the Gemara and the Gemara's very, very strong opposition on the one hand to Yochanan and to Yanai for selling out, so to speak, and yet the debate about what was behind that is, and part of what's really behind a lot of the whole interplay between Judaism and Hellenism was not only the culture themselves, but the fact that the Jewish people at this point were at a time in history in which they realized that in order to preserve their own cultural and religious identity, they needed to use political and military power. They needed to seek political sovereignty. And in order to become politically sovereign, that then forced them to confront all sorts of challenges. How do you hold on to that when there are these big powers all around you? And maybe the only way to maintain that sovereignty is to cut deals and to engage in diplomacy, right? To sign a treaty with Rome, who generations from now might destroy your temple, whether you know it or not. To bring foreigners into your country, but then you have to accommodate their culture, so to speak. Right? It's very, very perhaps comfortable to just be a religious minority and say, we don't have to rule ourselves, we'll be happy to pay our taxes and let them live our lives, but then you're at the mercy of those people who rule you, whether they'll let you live your lives or not. The Jewish people fought for this independence, gained it very, very briefly, lost it again to the Romans, ultimately fought several rebellions against the Romans, resulting in the destruction of their temple. One final rebellion after that, the Bar Kokhba rebellion, which ultimately resulted in a complete destruction of any last hopes of Jewish independence for thousands of years. The Jewish people went into exile after this and learned to once again live as religious minorities, subject to the good graces of whatever power ruled over them. After a few thousand years of experiences like that, we're now back in that same type of situation again. And a lot of what we face today in Medinat Yisrael, if you ask me, it can be viewed through this lens as well. Some Jews, religious and secular, and I'm talking about Israelis here, I'm not even talking about Jews in other countries, some Israelis, both religious and secular, if you listen to what they're really saying, they're longing for the day when we could just be a Jewish community ruled over by whatever government's in power and not to have to deal with the need to exert our own power. And others are saying, but the lessons of history show that we need to exert power, but exerting power means getting our hands dirty. And a lot of these issues are what's playing beneath the surface of a lot of these debates, both then and also now.
Thank you.
Thank you.